Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about a television show that we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the first season of Percy Jackson and the Olympians on Disney+. And I'm only going to be able to spoil the show. I can't spoil the books. I haven't read the books.
Neither have I.
I am aware of the books. I've been curious about it. We did see at least the first movie. I think we watched both movies and maybe even done episodes on them.
Yeah, we watched both for sure.
But that would have been whenever they came out, which I want to say was a good number of years ago.
10 years ago. And honestly, I think it's a good thing that we didn't rewatch the movies before the series.
Yes.
Because I feel like it, I mean, they're both based on the book. They followed the same basic storyline. So there were moments here where it's like, oh, and I forget the exact name of the store now, but we come upon Auntie M's or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, the statuary shop.
Yeah.
M's, as in Medusa, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right.
Well, for me, like when they got to the Camp Half-Blood, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
But as it was coming, not, oh, we're going to get to this.
Yes, exactly. And I think if we had just watched the movie, it would have felt more like I had spoilers in mind, as opposed to, as we got to things, it's, oh, that's right. Okay, I'm looking forward to this.
Well, when we watched The Golden Compass and His Dark Materials, which are both based on the same books, there were aspects of when we were watching the second version where it's like, okay, here's where they skipped over this or expanded on this or did this and went in a different direction or whatever. Or this character's introduction was different. So instead of thinking of them this way, I'm thinking of them that way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have any of that here because, again, there'd been enough space.
Yeah.
Because I don't even remember when we watched the movies. It was not when they first came out.
No, but I want to say, I mean, it was a good 5 years ago or more, I want to say.
Probably, yeah. I want to, that sounds right. I enjoyed this. I thought it was fun.
You know, I first of all, I really enjoyed it. But second of all, I want to say that when people say Percy Jackson, I think it's easy for the next thought to be, oh yeah, that's a kid's book. And I think that's unfair in a sense. Even if you say, oh yeah, that's young adults, I think that the thought and the plotting in this is really good.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it was written down in any way, shape, or form. To me, it falls in not so much the quote-unquote kids book arena, but a particular subset of fiction that this Harry Potter, to a certain degree, His Dark Materials.
When this is accessible to preteen readers.
Yes.
I would assume based, again, haven't read the books, but the material feels accessible to preteen readers. But in terms of adult literature and adult writing, there's foreshadowing and not telegraphed.
Yes.
But genuine foreshadowing. I liked the message from the Oracle, for instance. And I want to say I feel it's fair to attribute quite a few things we saw here to being in the book or from the book, because the writer of the book helped write some of the scripts, was an executive producer.
Right. I have seen some comments, though, that indicated that a few things changed a little, which you have to expect. Because, one, you're going from a book to a TV show.
Exactly.
Certain things are going to play differently there, pacing, timing, whatever.
And he's had time to think more about it.
Exactly. But this is a case where the original author is having the chance to, I don't say have a do-over, but tweak some things, enhance, change, whatever.
But even things that in some projects, it might be easy to say, oh, I think they forgot about a character, for instance, for, what, 5 episodes?
Yeah.
Because we see Luke in the first 2 episodes, and we don't see him again until the final episode.
Yeah.
But we also don't see...
Well, we did see him from the phone-a-friend aspect when they're getting to the...
That's true.
The casino. So he was in the narrative, but tangentially so.
Yeah. And then we had Clarice.
Yeah.
Again, up in...
Really, the main... Well, I guess the second episode with the camp.
Yeah.
And not again until across the way at the end.
But really, you needed both Luke and Clarice, because you had to have a red herring.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, and then at the end, you had to find out, okay, which of them is which in terms of who's the guilty party, who's the red herring.
Yeah.
But where other projects, it's tempting to say, I feel like they sidelined or forgot about a character for all these episodes. Here it was, no, they actually laid the foundation for what they wanted to do at the end.
I'm curious if the scene in the truck where they kind of do the magic or whatever to talk to Luke, if that was in the books or not.
Mm.
Because I could see adding that to keep the character, oh yeah, he exists.
Yes.
Because it was feeling, by the time we got to the end, it's like, oh yeah, we got the friend who betrays him. It seemed like it should have been Luke at the beginning. We've barely seen him since.
Yeah.
Turns out it was. If we hadn't had that thing in the middle, I would have felt it was not great writing.
Well, we hadn't seen him, but we'd encountered his father and had quite the conversation about him.
Well, and again, that was the same episode when they were getting,
give
or take one to the casino and stuff. So I can't really say how the books were compared to this or whatever. It seems like there was some strong material here.
Mm-hmm.
There were aspects where this felt very similar to Harry Potter. You've got the three, you've got the chosen one, the best friend, and the potential love interest.
Yeah. There were some visuals I loved.
Yes, there were some really good visuals. Overall, I would say the effects on this were well done. Disney Plus, though, go figure.
Yeah, well, but in St. Louis, there was one section where I'm like, wait, did we green screen and why?
Yeah, there were a few places where, no, I mean, we're an educated audience in the art of filmmaking and such. So it's not too surprising, I think, at least for the two of us, and I think a lot of people, I don't think we're unique in this, would be able to look at certain scenes saying, yep, that was green screened in.
Well, and I guess in terms of thinking through, okay, they've only got so much budget. I get it. You know, something has to give. But honestly, Grover, the satyr, he didn't have to have the goat legs even half as often as he did.
There were times early on when we were first getting the goat legs that what was running through my mind, it's like, okay, we've got this shot, so we see him from, you know, the waist up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we don't got to do the legs on that.
Yep.
And I've got to wonder, because in my mind, there was this potential friction playing out on set or behind the scenes of the person who shot it got the legs in because we wanted to see the legs. Somebody had to now go do the effects. They were upset. You know what I mean? And none of that, I'm sure, happened. But
well, but there was an aspect of somebody decided we want to see the legs as much as possible to show he's a satyr. But I'm sorry, the whole thing we established early on is that he has the ability, the magic, the whatever, to conceal that he's a satyr.
Not that he has that. It's that if you're human, you don't see the otherworldly aspects. But once you've become of that world, and we were following essentially through Percy's perspective.
But Percy didn't see him as a satyr until he was told he was a satyr.
And that was... No, he had seen the legs, asked what's up with that, and then was told he was a satyr. But to me, we were able to see into the godly realm or whatever as much as Percy could.
Yeah, I guess. I would have liked it better if Grover was blending with the humans when they were among the humans.
I would have liked it if we had cut to the innocent bystander perspective and seen what they were seeing.
Yeah.
You know, when we've got this crazy thing going on, what was everybody else seeing that us and Percy were not?
Yeah.
Or were, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we'd gotten one thing at the beginning where he was seeing, I forget what it was.
Oh,
like the giant rhinoceros or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And
some yellow thing.
Everybody else was seeing a garbage truck.
Yeah.
There are certain ways that work, certain ways that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And seeing the two sides of the veil, and if there had been, I mean, this is where doing the equivalent of a Star Wars wipe could have been very interesting. If there's something where it's like, okay, we're moving the curtain back and forth.
Yeah.
And we're able to see the mundane versus the magical.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there were some places where there were some gratuitous effects they didn't have to do, but I appreciated them doing. And I'm sure there had to be a discussion of when and where do we do this.
Mm-hmm.
There were other times where the effects were outstanding, and a few where, yep, they're standing in front of a green screen, but in a few cases for that shot, how else would you have done it?
Well, and that takes me back to St. Louis when we were on the street with the parked cars.
Yeah.
And that's why I was like, it feels green screen and I can't figure out why.
Well, with that sort of a thing, when you're compositing an intersection, traffic, animals, kids, etc., it just takes for one layer of that lighting to be just off enough that you notice it but can't pinpoint it.
But we had the adult walking, but we didn't have the animal in that shot, as I recall.
There were a couple of shots where I felt, again, also when we got to the casino, because part of it looked like there's this egg-shaped building in London.
Yeah.
We're always seeing that from a distance. There was buildings in front of it. And I'm thinking, it's like, well, they could only get this one shot of it. Therefore, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but none of it was, oh my God, they put that on the air?
Yeah, yeah. No, and I agree with that.
A few shows where it's like, they needed to spend a little more time on that shot.
Yeah.
I think they did really well with the casting.
Yeah, I agree with that. The other thing I'm going to say on the effects real fast, though, is we were seeing Grover's legs at the casino in Vegas, but we weren't seeing the other satyr's legs. Admittedly, he was wearing pants, but we weren't even seeing, like, the pants do funky things to imply the legs were bending a strange way.
At that point, when we saw the other one, we usually were not with Percy.
Okay.
And I think you could argue even the satyr had kind of forgotten he was a satyr.
Mm.
I mean, there's ways you can rationalize.
Yeah, that's the point.
Admittedly what I'm doing.
Yeah. All right, going back to the casting, I agree. It was fantastically cast. And some of the guest stars were just...
Yeah.
Wow. I'm so glad they brought some of these people in.
Well, let's start with the main cast, and then we'll get to the guest stars. I thought the kid they picked for Percy did a really good job.
Walker Scobell.
The one they picked for young Percy.
Okay, well, let's stop on Walker Scobell for a second,
sure.
Because this is only his, what, third project? And it turns out we've watched all three of them. So I gotta say, I love this kid's entire resume.
What was the first and second thing?
One of them was a Ryan Reynolds movie.
Oh, Adam Project.
Yes, and Secret Headquarters.
Secret Headquarters. Yeah, we've seen his entire body of work at this point.
Yes.
Which is funny, and he does well in all of them.
Yeah, he really does.
So he's got a promising career, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
The one who plays the young version of him. Now, granted, this kid is in...
The character's like 12.
Yeah. I was going to say 13, 14 tops.
Yeah.
So a younger version where he's, I don't know, 6 or 7 maybe?
Yeah. I mean, the actor is 15. I'm going to look up how old the younger one is. Asriel Dahlman, who I love this little trivia piece. Asriel Dahlman saw the other Percy's eyes in some footage, and he's like, I won't wear contacts to match the eyes because his eyes are so great on film. The younger one, the actor's actually 10. So 5-year difference in the actors. 5-year
difference, yeah.
And it does show on screen.
It does.
The age difference.
They're physically, you know.
Yeah.
But they look enough alike that it's like, yeah, I believe that's the younger one.
Yeah, yeah.
So did a terrific job. The mom was in there at the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
Really strong.
Yes.
Sold a lot of very moving scenes.
I loved how she sold the Why I Named You Percy scene.
Okay, now with the Why I Named You Percy, what I would love to see later in the series, and I doubt they ever do it in the books, I want to see Percy Jackson meet Perseus.
Oh, yeah.
His older brother. Because I think there's a lot of ways you could play that. Particularly with the, you're stealing my thunder, kid.
Yeah.
And then the one who played the satyr.
Aryan Simhadri, who played Grover.
Grover, yeah, he was an interesting character because there was, he's the almost, I don't say cliche, but standard sidekick, friend, comedic relief.
Combination comedic relief and peacekeeper.
Peacekeeper. I don't say mother hen of the group, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. In Medusa's basement, he had a great scene.
Yes. Well, and that was when it was revealed, not only was he Percy's protector, he was Annabeth's protector.
Was he Annabeth's or Thalia's?
I thought it was Annabeth's.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I just had gotten confused
No, because she's like, well, he was mine first.
Yeah.
And then Percy's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, which throws the timeline into question of, well, when did he leave her to go hang with Percy and stuff like that? There were a number of scenes that, in the hands of a lesser actor, would have felt forced, cliche or just not have played well.
I was thinking the not have played well. There was a scene on the bus with the song that would have been incredibly corny.
Yes.
In another actor's hands.
Yeah, there's 1,001 ways it could have gone wrong, half a dozen where it could have gone right, mm-hmm. and they found in that area.
Yeah.
And consistently. I think that actor has a lot of potential future, in my mind, mainly in like the sitcom,
mm-hmm.
or again, this sort of a role in movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just because that's the wheelhouse kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
There are some actors you look at and say, okay, they're going to be the leading man. There's some, they're going to be the character actor, or they're going to be the best friend, or they're going to fit this role, that role, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing right or wrong about that. And sometimes you get people who fit in one of those and they play one of the others. Sometimes it's like, oh yeah, it didn't work. Other times it's like, wow, that was surprising casting against type and it did work.
Yeah.
And the one who played Annabeth, I think she's got just a really promising future in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
She did a great job and was a really strong character.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, I thought the main cast just very solid. And I think it's challenging to get individually strong actors and stuff, more challenging to get them to where they play well against each other.
I thought the best scene for Annabeth and that actress was the one where she was explaining, my mother gave me to my father as a gift.
Yep, yeah.
And she just nailed that scene.
Well, and some of those where it's exposition and some stuff like that, it can be challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what gets me is not only did they get a very balanced and good cast, but doing it with actors at this age bracket.
Yes.
It's not like they've got 20 or 30 years worth of material to go look at or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing when you get a bunch of actors in their 40s or their 50s or later. It's like, well, they've got this long material and maybe you don't think of them in this way, but they did this one role 20 years ago and they, aced it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think the casting process on this was solid.
Well, and Percy, Annabeth, and Grover, there's your lead cast. Those were the three names for all the episodes.
They were the only ones in the opening credits.
Yeah.
Now, when we get to some of the guest cast, particularly some of the gods and such.
Yeah.
And they pulled out, I think, some really strong or at least very appropriate actors and such. Most of which I kind of recognized. A lot of them I would not say, oh, well, they're the big stars or something. Lin-Manuel Miranda is Hermes.
Yes, yes.
Probably one of the bigger names they had. But Adam Copeland as Ares,
mm-hmm.
he was terrific in Haven.
Yeah.
It was a really good spot for him to be in.
Yeah.
So that worked well. Hephaestus was
Timothy Amundsen.
From Psych.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't recognize him with the hairstyle and stuff like that, but he is a bit of a chameleon that way at times.
Yeah.
Because the look he had in Galavant versus in Psych.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great to see him having, because he'd had a stroke, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And he seems to have very much recovered from that, which is awesome. He's a terrific actor. And one that I would almost say is more character actor type.
Mm-hmm.
And again, his ability to literally blend in and become the role.
Yeah.
Some actors are terrific at that. Some, they play the same basic character every time.
Yeah.
And it's funny because those are the ones who usually become the big name Tom Cruise, John Wayne types or whatever.
Yeah.
Then one or two of the others they got, the one who played Poseidon was the dad on Lost in Space, the Netflix version.
Right. Toby Stevens.
He did a really good job. We didn't get a ton of him, but he was well used. Which other gods did we see? Well, Lance Hendrick as Zeus.
Lance Reddick. Yeah.
Lance Reddick, he did a great job.
You know, the scene between Zeus and Poseidon there towards the end up on Mount Olympus was just beautiful. The reaction shots and the brotherly strife, if you will.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because that's the only place we see Zeus.
Yeah.
So there was probably maybe a day or two, bring the guy in, do the scene, move on kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really the way you want to do it with some of these types of roles and actors, because it really opens up who you can get.
Yes. Well, when Percy's mom first talks about having met Poseidon, she really kind of builds up who he was, what he was, etc. But then in a flashback, when we first see her talking to Poseidon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got young Percy off in the background, basically a blur. That is an amazing scene for both her and Poseidon.
Yes. I don't know how much time they spent on that, but I could see where that was a good couple of days or whatever and well spent.
Mm-hmm. It was beautiful dialogue. It was just a really beautiful, you know, say it to me because you can say it to no one else.
Well, the way it starts of she and Percy are kind of butting heads a little bit, and he's like, why are you pushing me away? She can't really answer him. It's like, I'm going to go pay the bill.
Mm-hmm.
She goes off, goes to the bar, sits down, grabs some stuff, lights a match to make an offering to the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, there's a lighting change.
Mm-hmm.
We see the rain in the background, out the windows and stuff. And just, it was the equivalent of a rack focus. I don't know if it technically was or not. I don't remember the scene well enough. I don't think it was. But just the timing of as she's dropping the match and stuff, all of that kind of spins.
Yeah.
The visuals. I mean, that's credit to the guys doing the camera work, the lighting,
mm-hmm.
everything on that.
Yeah.
And then to lead into that scene of her and Poseidon having that face-to-face, well, which is something they clearly don't do often. I mean, they're side-by-side.
Exactly. I was going to say, ironic way to phrase it, face-to-face, because they're not face-to-face, and yet they're side-by-side having just this beautiful conversation without touching.
Well, it's the equivalent of, you know, the two spies sitting on the bench reading the paper talking to each other.
Yeah.
Without facing each other.
Yeah.
It's clearly this is a can't do this often, do it when it's important.
Yeah.
And this was one of those moments.
Yeah.
So it was a very well done scene, both the way it was written, the way it was shot, the way it was acted.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a great introduction to Poseidon proper, because we'd gotten hints of him around.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it lived up to the way she had described how she felt, you know, he was a man, but I realized he wasn't just better than any guy I'd ever met before.
Yeah. They did just a lot of good things with this. It's a fun, accessible
mm-hmm.
show that's got enough meat on the bone
mm-hmm.
that, I mean, I would say the only thing I would really nitpick is, again, the betrayal of the friend hinted at the beginning. You know, that friend drifted off in the plot for a little bit, but...
Well, I loved when he tells Annabeth, I chose you to come with me because you're not my friend, so you can't be the friend who betrays me.
Yes, yes. Wait, that didn't come out right, kind of.
I know, right?
And yeah.
I was waiting for him to tell Grover, and you've already betrayed me, so I figure if the friend who betrays me is you, it's over and done with.
Well, it's future tense. That was past tense. You're not going to do it again. You know, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and again, that whole betrayal scene back at the beginning with Grover.
Yeah.
Really spun that on a dime. And feeling the pain of Percy, if my friend just betrayed me, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of great moments there.
Yeah.
Now, I did not recognize the actor who played Hades, but I thought he did a really well,
mm-hmm.
good job. He struck me as if this had been a while back and the actor was, you know, was in the right age bracket or whatever, although he could have done it too. It reminded me of Jerry Burns from, among other things, Justified.
Yeah.
Different actor, but a little bit of that almost sensibility.
Yeah, Jay Duplass.
Yeah. And that's, again, another one where we see that actor in the one setting. So, again, in, do the role, out.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got the number of Greek gods we're going to go see over the course of this, I'm expecting that kind of almost hit-and-run deity, and I was surprised we saw as much as of Lin-Manuel Miranda as we did.
Yeah.
But that was another thing that made me be leaning towards comparing it to his Dark Material, because he was in there too.
Yeah. And I felt he had a good role there. I felt this was a better fit for him, if that makes sense.
It was a better fit, but I thought the role he played in his Dark Material was a better role. But I think the actor who did it in the movies did better,
because
it felt more Western.
Yeah.
And it felt like, again, that character and the relationship with the lead just kind of happened versus was built, you know.
Yeah.
And here, him being kind of Luke's father and such, and that's always talked around, I never felt we got total payoff on that.
We never got total payoff, and we never really got the foundation for why Luke was so upset with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I wish I could remember the story. I want to say I saw an article, you know, way back when the movies came out, that Rick Riordan had basically either written a chapter and that night he would read it to his kids as their bedtime story, or vice versa. He would tell his kids a chapter as a bedtime story and then go write it.
Go type it up the next night.
Hey, the kids enjoyed it. But as I recall, that was kind of how this came to be, as a, he wanted to tell his kids a story and stuff. And from that perspective, to me, it's really kind of interesting, the messages they're in here, in terms of a mom who wants her son to realize who he is before other people tell him who they want him to be.
Yeah, it was a little on the nose when she had to flat out tell us that.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah.
You know, but also a large number of dysfunctional families, and trying to appreciate the most functional role model in there. And when that most functional role model goes through hell, coming out of it saying, okay, it's time I divorced the deadbeat in my life.
Yep. Although that seemed to happen off panel.
Yes.
It wasn't until the end credit scene that we get that. And it was funny because we're at the end of the season. It's like, okay, we've checked the boxes. Because, again, we talked a little before watching the finale of what do they got to do? They checked most of the boxes, and then there was the whole bit of, what about this one character? We're going through the credits, and I'm like, I know there's going to be an end credit scene. It just, it feels that way. Going through the credits, and I'm like, okay, I think it's got to really address what's going on with this guy. And then we get that. Now, it didn't play out. I didn't have any expectations of how it would play out, so I didn't expect what we got. But it made sense, because it keyed in on some previous things.
Yeah.
So, and it was funny. That was kind of the end credit scene that has a bit of payoff and stuff in terms of, okay, it was worth sticking around to watch that.
Yes, it was, definitely, in a few ways.
Yeah. So overall, I really enjoyed this. I thought it was good. I'm curious about the books.
Me too.
I hope they get more seasons.
One of the things I want to say, because I did go, you know, look in our library and see what can we check out in the way of the books and stuff, because he's got the series. I want to say there's spinoff series, etc. One of the things I really respect about the author is he also wrote a book about the gods that's aimed at the young readers. And it's kind of a, do you want to know who really took care of Medusa, this, that, and the other?
Here's the read more about it aspect.
Yeah.
So to use an NBC analogy from back in the day. No, and that's cool, because I appreciate it when they do that sort of a thing. And if this is something that's going to get some kids or other people interested in mythology and stuff like that, it's just a wealth of great material out there.
And there's a lot of good Greek mythology material in here.
Yes. Yeah. And I am far, far from an expert in Greek mythology, but it seemed to play really well with it and understand it.
Far better than Hercules, the Kevin Sorbo show.
Well, or the Wonder Woman comics back in the day with, you know, Great Hera and By Jove or what have you, you know, and they're mixing the the pantheons. And one of the big things George Perez did was, let's go Greek and just be done with it.
Kind of deal.
And then later, I forget if it was John Byrne or who, but they did a story where not only did you have the Greek, but you had their Roman twins.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
You know, I liked how they explained enough of the mythology as we went without having to have somebody constantly not knowing everything and somebody constantly having to explain it all.
Well, but, like, I loved how Ares was explaining Kronos.
Yes.
With just kind of a, you know, of course my family is messed up. Look how we started.
But again, that foreshadowed Ares having been turned by Kronos.
Yes.
You know? So, the author played fair for the most part. So, I was pleased with that. And I think that's important in a book, particularly one that the kids are going to consume. Because that sets their expectations of story and how those sorts of things are supposed to unfold.
Yeah.
I think if you're raised on crappy stories, you don't really know a good one when you see it.
Well, and I think that in terms of a hero's journey and what makes a hero, Percy's a really good hero.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the tunnel of love might be corny, especially to our generation. But when we leap off the tunnel of love ride to rescue the shield, and Percy realizes the trick, the trap, whatever we want to say, Hephaestus has made, and consciously steps into it.
Yeah.
Understanding the bargain that must be made.
he's willing to sacrifice when he has to, but not do it stupidly either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's got backbone when he needs to have it, but it's not all bravado.
Yeah.
He walks a fine line in a number of respects.
Yeah.
That make him a fun and interesting character. He's the last to realize something when it's a little funny, but not, oh, geez, he's an idiot.
Yes.
He's the first to realize certain things. There's mm-hmm. one or two times where it feels like he's holding back a little information.
Yeah.
Because I think he was suspecting Luke a little earlier than he could really prove down at the end.
Yeah. And for that matter, I liked Annabeth in the field of sorrows and regrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think back at the Waterland, Waterworld, whatever that park was with Hephaestus, I think we actually got hints of Annabeth having regrets.
Yes. Yes. And showing she's not the... I'm trying to think how to phrase this. She was picked because Percy thought there would be times somebody needed to make the hard call and she would always make it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a case where she was explicitly not doing that.
Yeah.
So again, rounding that character out.
How do you phrase it? If someone has to push me down a flight of stairs to complete the mission, I know she'll do it without a second thought.
Yeah. And it turns out it was roles reversed in St. Louis.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to another season of this. I really hope they get it.
Me too.
And I don't know when they shot this versus the actor, writer, strike, all that kind of a thing in terms of how much of these kids aged up. Because that's an issue with leads of this age.
Lance Reddick, who plays Zeus, I want to say passed away in March of 2023.
So about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids could easily have aged another year or two.
Yeah.
You can, depending how they age, you can work around that. Depends on the timeline of the story and some stuff like that. Because
mm-hmm.
we noticed that in the Lost in Space Netflix series, where suddenly, you know, between I think it was seasons 2 and 3, Will had grown about a foot.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, we've been on this planet for a year. It's okay. And there was one show we watched, The Astronauts.
Yeah.
Where I think part of what killed it was the pandemic and the kids, I don't say aging out, but I fear there was some of that involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, if that was the case, that was unfortunate because they could have easily said, we thought it'd take 200 days or whatever. It took longer.
Yeah.
You know, they could have played that out of, yeah, we thought it was a weekend cruise and we're here for 3 years kind of a deal, you know?
Yeah.
So I think when doing a multi-year, multi-book kind of saga, writing it, you can control the aging of the characters. Filming it, you cannot.
Yeah. The two other actors I want to mention were Megan Mullally as Electo.
Mm, yeah.
Who was just so much fun to watch.
Yes, yes.
And the headmaster, Hiro Kanagawa, who was in Upload and quite a few other shows.
Lost. And who played the centaur? Because that was another character actor who was really well used.
Oh, Chiron?
Chiron, yeah.
Glenn Turman. I looked him up on IMDb. The man has just a fantastic number of credits. 178 credits.
Spanning decades.
Yeah. I want to say it went back to like the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if this man has not written a book about his career, I wish he would, because it is just phenomenal. He worked on the original Hawaii Five-O, the Doris Day Show, Room 222. I mean, yeah.
It's, and that's just the classic end of the spectrum of his work. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. I mean,
and still working today.
Goes back to 1961. He did Matlock in the 80s. It's just fantastic. All the credits he's got. Touched by an Angel in 2000.
Well, and I like that group of actors that fall into the category he does of, you might not recognize him,
mm-hmm.
or you'll recognize him, but have no idea where from.
Yeah.
You hit the IMDb page, you realize he's done everything under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So finding out what you recognize him from can be impossible, because there's thousands of choices, it seems like.
Yeah.
But those are the types of actors that are the backbone.
Yes.
Of all of these productions, because we need the people who play the headmaster or the bus driver or the guy next door, the mailman, or, you know, the CEO of the company, or, you know, whatever.
Yes.
Their functionary roles, their character actor types.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot film series, movies, or whatever without them, usually. And they don't get the credit they deserve. And I think that's a lot of, you know, what every time we have the writers and actor strikes or those negotiations and stuff, they're the rank and file that are making a living, but not necessarily a great living,
yeah,
doing this kind of stuff.
A great example of that is the guy who played the super, who back in, what, the first episode, yeah, I thought looked familiar. Okay, his name is Simon Chen. He has 99 credits.
We saw him for a minute of the show, if that.
Oh, and
he was a great character.
And he cracked me up.
Yeah, he had a good line.
Yeah.
A good interplay with Percy. He recognized Percy. He'd been in there fixing something, and the stepdad was upset. He was leaving. Percy was coming in.
Yeah.
Percy was apologizing. No, I should apologize. You know,
yeah.
Just so much in such a short role, and it's the sort of thing that adds flavor to a show and gives a reality to the narrative.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that, you know, we always think about the Hollywood actors getting the bazillion dollars or whatever. These guys aren't doing that, but you can't have these kinds of shows without them, and they would suffer if they did.
Exactly.
Because you could have cut that scene out, and Percy could have just walked in the door, and it would have lessened the show a little.
It definitely would have, because that little scene let us know the frame of mind Stepdad was in as we walked in.
The nature of Stepdad, he's
yes.
Just an unhappy person to begin with, that Percy may feel invisible, but he's making friends and people like him.
Yes.
And there's just a ton of little information and subtle things that are baked into that 30 seconds or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a credit to the writing. It's a credit to how it was shot and filmed and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, again, when I say it was a solid cast, I would be hard-pressed to name anyone that I think, wow, they should have replaced or something like that.
We didn't mention Medusa.
Oh, Medusa. That was Nora from The Flash.
Yeah. Jessica Parker Kennedy.
Yes. And that was one of you had recognized her. And part of it is she's wearing a hat. We can't see the face. Got the voice. She sounded a little older, frankly, than Nora, but that was an actress playing a younger aged character, too, in The Flash.
Yes.
And here, she's playing somebody, you know, millennia old.
Well, and that's the thing. In The Flash, I almost want to say she was more of the giddy teenager.
Yep.
Whereas here, she was playing the provocative adult.
Yes. And it really shows the range of the actress.
Yeah. And the first thing I said to you was the voice. It's one of the women off one of the CW superhero shows.
You said CW shows. You didn't specify superhero, but
okay,
that was half their lineup, so yeah. I narrowed it down.
You know, but then I just started going through, okay, I don't think it's Gypsy, and I was just narrowing down.
Yeah, why? You had labeled Gypsy, Jesse Quick, and Nora, and I didn't think it was any of them, but then we got a little further. It's like, yeah, it is Nora.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Again, they picked some people that are recognizable, at least to us in kind of the geek culture and stuff, but they use them fairly well and aren't totally just banking on the, oh, you're going to recognize them. It's not stunt casting.
Well, we scanned back through one episode three times.
Oh, yes. It was one where the one who played Disher on Monk was listed.
Jason Gray Stanford as Marin.
And he's a recognizable actor because he's a little skinnier, fun, you know, he's got a way of speaking. He's tall, you know, whatever. And we scan back through. It's like the only scene he could have been in is if he's one of the guys in this Seder Council or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, he was.
But he didn't have a line of dialogue.
Didn't have a line of dialogue. We only see him in a group shot at a distance.
In heavy makeup.
In heavy. Yes. So I hope he didn't have to spend too much time in the chair for no lines of dialogue.
Oh, I'm certain he did, and I suspect he had lines of dialogue, and they're on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, that was kind of funny, though.
I really hope that there is a Blu-ray edition with deleted scenes, and he's in there.
That would be interesting for some of these Disney Plus shows if they're doing releases like that, because I think Blu-rays, DVDs are falling out of fashion.
That's very true.
And I don't know if they're doing kind of the deleted scenes or whatnot.
Deleted scenes, director's cut, whatever.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Because we've seen a couple of movies where it's like, oh, that's what they were trying to do. Or that's what the writer did and the director decided not to.
Yeah, it was.
It was the love story in the middle of the Star Wars prequel trilogy.
Yes.
Between Anakin and Padme.
Yeah.
That they just edited out.
Yeah, I loved the introduction to almost every one of those deleted scenes of, I really didn't feel this contributed to the story I was telling.
Yeah, it's a shame you weren't telling the Star Wars story where this is the love part between those two to set up, you know, the whole main trilogy.
I know, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if we hadn't listened to the introductions of the deleted scenes, we'd have still been mystified.
But that's where I think Percy Jackson and the Olympians had the advantage of the author of the books was one of the lead writers of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So knew the story they were telling.
Yes.
And knew how to enhance or deviate if and when needed.
Yeah.
And I think it showed because it was a very solid show. Mm-hmm. And I think with His Dark Material, there was one writer for at least one or two of the seasons that was most of the writing. And it was a strong season. But then there was a bit after where it's like, ah, I kind of meandered a little.
Yeah.
So I think having a strong creative vision helps. When you're adapting a series of books, if you can get the author, great. That helps a lot. But even if everybody in the room has read the book, did they get the same thing out of it?
Well, I was going to say, there's also a clear appreciation and respect for the Greek mythology.
Yes.
Whereas you go back to the Kevin Sorbo Hercules show, and there was one episode where it's not even the plot, it's the subplot of the episode. 50 women are chasing him around for the episode. And at the end, he turns around and he tells them, I respect you too much as women to sleep with you. That's a great modern message, but I hate to break it to you. In Greek mythology,
yes,
he slept with all 50 women and fathered children by all 50 of them.
I do think doing Greek mythology in the modern era requires some rethinking of certain story points.
And, you know, I'm great with the modern message. I approve of the modern message. I love the modern message. But you didn't have to pick that storyline.
I was going to say, how do you put the modern sensibility into the ancient mythology and make both mindsets compatible where you can?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's again, that's challenging when you do that. But again, if you're going to adapt a book, we're watching a lot of shows that are adaptations of books.
Yes.
Foundation, Silo, to name two others.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, in many of these cases, I haven't read the books, so I can't say how well they're adapting them. Having a writer's room that has the same understanding of the source material helps a lot. And I felt this was a very focused season on this.
Well, but we also find, at least I find, that when they're coming from a book, or even frankly, when they're coming from comic books, they have this depth of material.
Well, that's two different things. For me, when you're doing it from a book, you've got the depth of a material.
Yes.
When you're doing it from a comic book, you've got a depth of a zillion materials. And that's hard.
Well, and from a book, you've got a beginning, a middle, and an end.
You've got a narrative trajectory to go through and a stability. I couldn't tell you how many different writers they had over the 8 episodes here, but it felt like it had a singular voice.
That is a very interesting question. I've got IMDb open, and I am going to see if I can find out. Because I did notice that Rick Riordan did not write all of the episodes, wasn't in the writing credits for all the episodes. It said that 11 people got series writing credits. Daphne Olive is staff writer on 8 episodes. And then it goes to Rick Riordan for created by, Rick Riordan for based on the book series by, it's funny, they only put that on 5 episodes. Then for the other 3, it's based on the book series Percy Jackson and the Olympians. I wonder why we're distinguishing.
That's interesting, because didn't he write all the books?
Yeah, but I'm wondering if Percy Jackson and the Olympians is different from Percy Jackson Lightning Thief.
I thought that was the first book of the series.
It is. So I wonder if anything got pulled from the other books, which is why 3 episodes credit Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
All right, we're going to need to consider looking at the books at some point.
Yeah. Jonathan E. Steinberg gets written for television by for 6 episodes and created by for 8 episodes. Joe Trax gets written for television by for 2 episodes. Monica Owusu-Breen gets written for television by for 1 episode.
A number of people in the room.
And then Andrew Miller, written for television by for 1 episode. And Craig Silverstein, written for television by for 1 episode. And I feel like I stopped noticing Rick Riordan for those final episodes in the written by credits. Like, he wrote the first five, and that's
probably
just
enough to get it started or something.
Yeah, and that's just what I feel like, because the last two, I feel like I didn't see his name on those in the writing credits.
Okay. Clearly, he was in the room and overseeing whether he was physically in there or not.
Yeah.
And they all seem to have a consistent vision and approach to the characters. And that helped a lot. And that made it feel solid as a series. And we've seen some where it's like, what the hell happened? Certain characters are in every other episode, or, you know, things of that sort.
Well, and there were two people with the last name Riordan in the executive producer credits, which had me wondering if maybe his wife was helping produce.
Could be.
And frequently you'll have an executive producer who's in charge of the writing room. And then you'll have, like, an executive producer who's kind of in charge of set, if you will.
Yeah.
And then that person really depends on their personality, how active they are, if they're on set every day.
Yeah.
Or if they're accessible by phone to set every day.
Yeah. And that may come down to how busy they are with other projects, too.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm hoping they get another season. They did really well with this one, and it's got me curious about the books and wanting to watch more.
Yeah. I feel they knocked it out of the park, and they gave us a roller coaster ride in all the best ways.
Yes. Yeah.
And I feel like, for the most part with the visuals, I feel like they sold them just right in terms of, like, the tree for Thalia.
Yes.
And stuff. The one thing I feel that they may have overdone in ways I didn't always understand was reveals of people in terms of, like, Mom. When we weren't seeing her face, and then we revealed Mom, I thought we were going to be revealing an actress I recognize or something to that effect because of the drawn-out nature of it. And I don't know if that was just my misunderstanding the directing or what, but I felt we got quite a few people reveals. That may have just been kind of them setting us up for, this is a character you're going to keep seeing. Take note.
Well, and 9 times out of 10, that was a god they were doing that with.
Yes.
And it was funny because when we got what turned out to be the reveal of Hermes, it wasn't clear it was Hermes.
Yes, I agree.
Until later.
Yeah.
So I thought that was funny. And that was another one where a guy in an elevator, have somebody come in, shoot for 20 minutes, they're done, you know, once they've gotten makeup and outfit and stuff. So that seemed like an easy thing. So for him to be in a full another episode later was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. And he may have filmed it when he came in for that other episode.
Almost certainly. If he did not, that was a mistake.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.